This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: the leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says Biden's regional visit is aimed at getting Arab states to increase their oil production amid the U.S.'s indirect war with Russia. Inflation in the United States jumped again in June, notching another 40-year high. And also, frustrated people take to the streets in Panama and Haiti to show their anger over price hikes and fuel shortages. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. The leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says U.S. President Joe Biden's West Asia visit is aimed at convincing Arab states to boost their oil production as part of Washington's anti-Russia measures. Said Hassan Nasrallah said the U.S. administration wants regional Arab states to supply energy to Europe so the West would be able to cut off energy imports from Russia. He said the U.S. means to reduce Russia's oil and gas revenues amid Washington's indirect war against Moscow in Ukraine. Nasrallah also touched upon Hezbollah's recent dispatch of three unarmed drones to a Mediterranean gas field, which is disputed with Israel. He said the operation was aimed at showing that the Kurdish field is not safe for gas extraction operations.
We want the Israeli to take it down because we want their fighter jets to go up and go and shell rockets. We want them to hit their rockets. We want their rockets to come. We want fire to begin in their region in order for that ship and the engineers on that ship, on all those people on that ship, to know that they are working in a place which is not safe, that there is a true threat in that area.
Nasrallah said the drone operation was just a humble start, adding that a new formula is coming. He said if Lebanon is barred from maritime gas extraction, no one will be allowed to extract gas and oil, and no one will be able to sell gas or oil. The Hezbollah leader emphasized that the movement is able to hamper Israeli efforts to extract oil and gas from the Kurdish field. Nasrallah warned that Hezbollah is ready to take necessary military measures to protect Lebanon's rights. Nasrallah said Lebanon has a golden opportunity in the next 2 months to secure its maritime rights before the Israeli regime completes work at Kurdish. He urged Lebanese officials to use the movement as leverage in their maritime demarcation talks, saying Hezbollah is Lebanon's only strong point. Earlier, we were joined by our Beirut correspondent, Mariam Saleh, who gave us a roundup on the Hezbollah Secretary General's remarks about the Kaddish oil field dispute with Israel.
Said Nasrallah has basically uncovered the plans of the United States. He's uncovered what is happening behind the closed doors, what is happening behind all these talks and the so back and forth envoys of the U.S. coming to Lebanon for the issue of the so-called demarcation. That the main issue is the fact that the Americans need to provide petrol and gas to the Europeans. And they're striving for the fact that the Israelis provide that gas, provide that petrol, and leave Lebanon in that state of chaos, a state of economic collapse, let it undergo a state where they could not even provide 1 hour of electricity, which the Americans had promised. They had promised 1 year ago that they would give Lebanon an exception from the CSAR Act in order to be given gas from Egypt through Jordan, also through Syria, to have several hours of electricity. That has not been realized because he said that the main project is to put Lebanon in chaos, in addition to prohibiting Lebanon from drilling and extracting its own natural resources. So what we have here is the leader of the resistance basically saying that the resistance is ready to even start a war, not just be ready to deter the Israelis from any sort of invasion, or even to be ready to stop Israeli threats. They are actually ready to even start a war in order for Lebanon to extract its rights.
The U.S. president arrives in Israel for the opening leg of his first visit to West Germany since taking office in 2021. Despite widespread criticism over his trip, Joe Biden has vowed to boost Washington's military support for Tel Aviv.
And with this visit, we're strengthening our connections even further. We have reaffirmed the unshakable commitment of the United States to Israel's security, including partnering with Israel on the most cutting-edge defense systems in the world. From here, I'm going straight to a briefing on Israeli missiles and rocket defense capabilities, including the U.S. support for the Iron Dome and Israel's new laser-enabled system called the Iron Beam.
Biden was speaking upon arrival in Tel Aviv. Earlier, Palestinian resistance groups denounced Biden's visit for serving the interests of the Israeli regime. After wrapping up his visit to the occupied territories, Biden will take an unprecedented direct flight from Israel to Saudi Arabia on Friday. He will hold talks with the kingdom's officials and attend a summit of political and economic bloc of six Arab countries, known as the GCC. U.S. lawmakers, including some Democrats, have already criticized Biden's trip to Saudi Arabia. They have cited the president's promise to put human rights at the heart of his foreign policy. Rights advocates also say Biden's trip could embolden Saudi Arabia to crack down on dissent abroad and restrict civil liberties domestically. Well, reactions are pouring in over the U.S. president's trip to Israel. A rights group has denounced the visit by putting up banners and billboards in the occupied West Bank city of Bethlehem to remind Joe Biden that Israel is an apartheid regime. Israeli rights group Bet Salam says the U.S. government should be held accountable for the Israeli regime's violations and crimes against Palestinians in occupied territories. It has also called on international bodies to push for an end to the Israeli apartheid system. Biden's visit and his meetings with Israeli officials are taking place at a time when the regime has intensified its deadly crackdown against Palestinians. Meanwhile, the May killing of veteran Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh has clouded Biden's trip. Washington has said there was no evidence the killing was intentional. That's why the United Nations Rights Office inquiry has concluded that Abu Akleh was in fact murdered by Israeli forces, quote, several single seemingly well-aimed bullets. The U.S. government's latest data shows inflation in the country reached a new 40-year high in June. According to the Labor Department, the Consumer Price Index was at 9.1% last month. That's higher than U.S. officials had expected and is the fastest increase in four decades. Energy prices also posted their biggest annual rise in more than 40 years. Many Americans are blaming the U.S. monetary policies and the current administration's mismanagement for the high inflation.
No, I don't think the government's done a good job because all last year this began and they did nothing because they thought it was temporary. And, you know, during the pandemic, everybody got passed out money, including stores and all of that. And so it's like, too much money floating around. They were very late to the game.
Well, I think the Federal Reserve said it was temporary, so I think maybe we could blame the Fed more than we can blame President Biden. They kept saying it was temporary for quite a while, and they finally had to change their tune.
Well, following the release of the data, President Joe Biden acknowledged that the inflation rate is unacceptably high. Still, he argued that the figure is out of date and does not reflect a clear drop in energy prices since mid-June. The central bank last month implemented the biggest interest rate hike in nearly 30 years to rein in the inflation, but so far, that has not been effective. Construction workers turn out in several cities across Panama to show that they're fed up with an inflation rate that's going through the roof. Union members took part in massive protests paralyzing the streets in the capital, Panama City. They accuse the government of robbing the poor to feed the rich. Wednesday's demonstration followed weeks of angry protests in Central American nation. In recent weeks, protesters spilled out into the streets, erecting roadblocks to demand a halt to rising fuel and food costs. They also want the government to curb public spending, with the exception of education, as consumers are bearing the brunt of the steadily creeping prices. The government has announced price controls for some food items along with some austerity measures to curb inflation, but the demonstrations continue regardless. Well, Panama is not the only country bordering the Caribbean Sea that's plagued by protests. Haiti is also witnessing a wave of unrest as anger mounts over fuel shortages. Protesters blocked roads in the capital, Port-au-Prince. Gas stations across the country are mostly closed in light of a turf war between rival gangs near one of Haiti's major fuel terminals. The week of gang violence in Port-au-Prince has left some 90 people dead, accelerating a downward spiral in the security situation. Political unrest and violence rocked Haiti a year ago when its president was gunned down at his residence. But the country's politics continue to be in a state of disarray, with the office of the president still vacant, a short-staffed and ill-equipped police force that is unable to control the street gangs has worsened the situation. European countries are feeling the pinch of the economic fallout of the Russia-Ukraine war. The value of the euro has now fallen to a 20-year low against the U.S. dollar. There are also concerns of a recession in major EU economies like Germany. Hashtag Trending takes a review of the story on social media.
Hey everyone, welcome to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. The exchange rates between the euro and the U.S. dollar reached parity on Tuesday, with the euro reaching its lowest point in two decades. This comes amid fears that an energy crisis caused by the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war would plunge the eurozone into an economic recession. The dip is part of a longer-term trend, with the euro weakening against the dollar 8% this year. It brings the euro closer to dollar parity, something unseen since the creation of the euro in 1999. People in Europe have been paying more for food and energy as a result of the economic consequences of the Ukraine war. Russia blames the global food and energy crises on Western sanctions against the country. Let's take a look at this chart with our first tweet of the day attached to it by Holger Scheipitz. This chart shows why euro crashed to near parity with dollar this week. Eurozone's trade surpluses have been completely wiped out because of energy crisis. Germany has slipped into trade deficit for first time in 31 years. Shortfalls in trade were also observed in France and other countries. Richard Hart has our next tweet. The euro is dying against the dollar. It's broken down under historic 30 years of support levels. Perhaps the EU should be more cryptocurrency friendly. A tweet by a member of the European Parliament, Christine Anderson, reads, "The euro is at its lowest level in 20 years. Soon parity with the dollar will be reached. The ECB, together with the decisions of the EU Commission, is creating an EU soft currency. Germany mourns the hard D mark." Danielle Lacal said, "The euro is not just weaker versus the USD due to the eurozone trade deficit. It has been weakening since 2008 due to a worse monetary policy than the U.S. The fall of the euro is linked to growing fears about the likelihood of a recession in the 19-nation eurozone. Survey data has shown a slowing in business growth across the zone, and indicators suggest that the whole region could plunge into decline as the cost of living crisis tightens consumer demands. Our next batch of comments starts with a tweet by Eklavya Gupta. Is Europe going to be the worst performer this year? With a lot of energy outsourced to Russia, price rise of 4 to 5 times already witnessed, with the most dovish monetary policy already in place, there seems to be little room. Hashtag European Union, hashtag Ukraine-Russia war. Vugar Bayramov has our next tweet. The first time the euro fell to parity with the dollar in the last 23 years as the eurozone's deepened energy supply crisis, negative adjustment of macroeconomic forecasts and economic woes continue to weaken the common currency. David Kudla said energy, lack thereof, has crippled the eurozone economy. Germany has first trade deficit in 31 years. Benjamin Norton has our next tweet. The euro has depreciated so much it's now equal to the U.S. dollar for the first time in 20 years. Economist Michael Hudson argues the U.S.-led sanctions war aimed at separating Europe from Russia/China and keeping it dependent on the U.S. is making Europe an economic dead zone. That's a wrap for another edition of Hashtag Trending. Thanks for staying tuned.
Elsewhere in France, the ride-hailing company Uber has always been viewed with skepticism, but a leak of company documents now shows their influence has already reached the very top. President Emmanuel Macron is facing calls for a parliamentary inquiry regarding alleged secret deals he made to break Uber into the French market. Romeo Mazzari has more from Paris.
French President Emmanuel Macron has become the highest-profile name tarnished by the so-called Uber files, a massive leak of company documents. The whistleblowing appears to detail the ride-hailing company's law-breaking and collusion with political elites across the West. While economy minister under his predecessor, François Hollande, Macron apparently held secret meetings which resulted in secret deals that undermined laws created to regulate Uber, satisfy taxi drivers, protect passengers, and honor the National Labor Code. French leftist parliamentarians have openly accused Macron of favoring the interests of an American company over those of his own government. Macron faced similar accusations in 2015 when he guided the sale of French energy giant Alstom to America's General Electric. A defiant Macron shockingly said he would, quote, do it again tomorrow, even though Uber's promises of good jobs and economic prosperity have resoundingly failed in France and elsewhere and caused many indebted taxi drivers to commit suicide.
Taxi drivers are not surprised. We saw that Uber is not good at creating jobs, but for creating a new type of slavery. We love our jobs and our cities, and passengers understood that, and Uber has lost here. Uber dangerously does not respect the laws over and over again, while Macron needs this type of behind-the-scenes lobbies to inflict his type of politics.
Macron has often been accused of attempting the Uberization of all of French society. The accuracy of that criticism appears more just than ever.
Uber has reaped the consequence of their nonsense in France because the government refused to control them with our laws. Uber is more expensive than taxis now and not popular. The Uber market can compete with the taxi market, but there has to be regulation.
The scandal is a reminder that while Western liberal economics claims to be based on fair, free market competition, political corruption is routinely employed to create monopolies, inequalities, and to subvert democratic laws. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
In the limelight.
In Britain, former Chancellor of the Exchequer Rishi Sunak, whose resignation alongside former Health Secretary Sajid Javid set off the mass walkout that led to British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's downfall, is a controversial figure for Tory leadership in his party, despite his staunch backing from MPs, and is blamed by many Tories for the rapid increase in the tax burden on his watch. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Heather Stewart, Jessica Elgott and Aubrey Allegretti. The piece is titled Wide Open Race for Tory Leadership Lays Bare UK Party Divisions. Conservative divisions were laid bare on Tuesday, 12th of July, as a wide-open field of 8 MPs made it through to the first round of the fractious contest to succeed Boris Johnson as Prime Minister. Despite the 1922 committee setting a threshold of 20 MPs to secure a place on the ballot paper, just 3 of the 11 declared candidates were eliminated on a frenetic day in Westminster. Former Chancellor of the Exchequer Rishi Sunak is the front-runner among MPs by some margin, with a publicly declared support of more than 40 colleagues, but it remains unclear who will join him in the final two. Conservative MPs will vote in the coming days, with any contender attracting fewer than 30 votes eliminated. Further rounds will follow until the field is narrowed to just two, with Conservative members then making the final decision. Former Secretary of State for Health and Social Care Sajid Javid, whose resignation helped precipitate Boris Johnson's demise, dropped out of the race shortly before the formal announcement of the candidates by 1922 committee chair Graham Brady on Tuesday evening. The former Health Secretary Sajid Javid did not immediately endorse any of his rivals. Sir Graham Brady said eight candidates had met the threshold to proceed. They are Kemi Badenoch, Suella Braverman, Jeremy Hunt, Penny Mordaunt, Rishi Sunak, Liz Truss, Tom Tuggenhat, and Nadeem Zahawi. Rishi Sunak, whose resignation alongside Sajid Javid set off the mass walkout that led to Boris Johnson's downfall, is a controversial figure in his party, despite his staunch backing from MPs, and is blamed by many Conservatives for the rapid increase in the tax burden on his watch. The Culture Secretary Nadine Dorries, who announced her support for Liz Truss recently, claimed Dirty Tricks had helped get Jeremy Hunt into the next round. She tweeted, "Team Rishi want the candidate they know they can definitely beat in the final two, and that is Jeremy Hunt." Rishi Sunak's team flatly denied, urging some of his supporters to lend their votes to Jeremy Hunt to help him over the line. A source in Jeremy Hunt's team said, "This is categorically untrue, and we hope all candidates and supporters will campaign on their own merits, rather than attempting to smear opponents." Earlier, three candidates, that is Kemi Badenoch, Rishi Sunak and Tom Tuggenhat, held simultaneous launch events. Tom Tuggenhat, considered to be a centrist, was introduced by his highest-profile backer, Anne-Marie Trevelyan, the Trade Secretary. He said his leadership would rise to the challenges of the cost-of-living crisis in a way his cabinet rivals had not. Tuggenhat said, "In a moment that is so desperate for so many, and when our service is most needed, we have retreated. We have retreated into division when we desperately need unity. When our nation needed our party to function, we retreated into faction. When the moment demanded service, we delivered scandal." Kemi Badenoch was watched at her event by Michael Gove, sacked as Community Secretary by Boris Johnson recently as he fought to save his premiership. In a speech in front of union flags that earned her a standing ovation from a packed room at the Policy Exchange think tank, Badenoch criticised the betrayal of rivals' tax cut pledges, which she said they would not keep. She said she would not enter into a bidding war with MPs who claim "my tax cut is bigger than yours," but she was committed to reducing taxes on businesses, on families and individuals. Penny Mordaunt and Liz Truss are expected to launch their campaigns soon, with both vying to be the Stop Rishi candidate who could win over the party membership. Throughout the day, the backers of contenders who had not yet met the threshold of 20 supporters frantically tried to win around their colleagues. The Home Secretary, Priti Patel, announced just before 2 p.m. local time that she would not be standing. There had been rumours that she might strike a deal with her fellow Brexiter, Braverman, but Priti Patel declined to publicly back any other candidate. She claimed in a statement, "Like all Conservative MPs and party members, I will be listening to cases being put forward by the candidates standing for the leadership of the party, and trust the contest will be conducted in a good spirit that brings our party together." Raymond Chishti, the little-known backbencher who had launched a quixotic leadership bid despite having no declared supporters, withdrew. Rishi Sunak was introduced at his launch by the Deputy Prime Minister, Dominic Raab. Raab claimed the former Chancellor was a true Conservative, imbued with the values of enterprise, hard work and family. Rishi Sunak's values are our values, he said. Grant Shapps, the Transport Secretary, also attended Sunak's slickly managed event, having folded his own campaign as it became clear he was unlikely to secure 20 backers. Other senior supporters present included Oliver Dowden, who resigned as Conservative Party chair after the disastrous by-elections in Tiverton and Honiton and Wakefield, and the former International Trade Secretary, Liam Fox. Rishi Sunak had no new policies to announce, claiming he wanted to have a grown-up conversation with the public instead of making lavish promises on tax cuts, as some of his rivals have done. With some MPs charging he has been disloyally plotting against Johnson, Sunak paid tribute to the outgoing Prime Minister, claiming, "Boris Johnson is one of the most remarkable people I've ever met, and whatever the commentators say, he has a good heart." He denied that Johnson's controversial former Chief of Staff, Dominic Cummings, had any involvement in his campaign or would be handed a role in any government I have the privilege to lead. Shortly before Rishi Sunak's launch, Nadine Dorries made a statement alongside the Brexit Opportunities Minister Jacob Rees-Mogg, in which they both said they would support Liz Truss. Nadine Dorries claimed she's probably a stronger Brexiter than both of us. She has consistently argued for low tax policies, adding that it was important to ensure the 2019 Tory manifesto was enacted. Jacob Rees-Mogg highlighted the fact that Liz Truss had argued in cabinet against Rishi Sunak's tax rises.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Deported.
Part 2.
We join Yusuf's family as they go to visit Yusuf in prison, a 3-hour drive from their house in Tampa into the southern swamps of Florida. It has been almost 5 months since Yusuf has been imprisoned, awaiting his deportation hearing. It is now just 2 days away. Samir Megahed, Yusuf's father, tries to remain hopeful.
We are so patient and we can wait. But this life of my son, they want to destroy him. by putting him in a jail waiting for his winning after 1 week, 1 month, 1 year. Nobody knows. Nobody knows. I'm going to advise him to be patient, to be in good condition in front of the judge, to let the judge know the truth about this case.
Yusuf's trial is held in the Chrome Jail in the swamps outside Miami. ICE has flown in a team of four lawyers to try the case. Yusuf's lawyer, Charles Cook, has agreed to take the case for free. No cameras are allowed inside.
We are currently in the second day of the trial. We just finished the testimony of the government's first witness, both his cross-examination and his direct examination. What's at stake is what young Muslim men in America can do and act like in America today. The reality here is, if you're a Muslim in America, you can't think like everybody else. You can't think like your colleagues. I have another client that we went to lunch with a few weeks ago who's about the same age as Yusuf. And I was telling him about Yusuf's case, and it was very interesting what he said. He had very little sympathy for Yusuf. He says, what is he thinking in America as a Muslim man? You can't go surfing on the internet, look at sites. You can't hang around with other people that are Muslims and talk about Islam. And I frankly find that sad.
David Cole is a law professor at Georgetown University Law Center and an expert in constitutional and First Amendment rights. He says that the targeting of immigrants in America is nothing new.
Historically, whenever the United States has faced a security threat, it has responded by targeting immigrants with its most restrictive measures. And I think that's partly because it's easy to do so. You know, it's one thing to say to American people, we face a greater security threat. You've got to sacrifice some of your liberties and rights in order to protect the country. But it's another thing to say to American people, we face a greater security threat, but we're going to give you more security by sacrificing somebody else's rights, namely foreign nationals, immigrants, people who have no voice in the political process. We did it in 1919 after a series of terrorist bombs. We went out and rounded up thousands of foreign nationals on pretextual charges, charges of guilt by association. Not one of them was ever found to have been involved in any of the bombings. During World War II, we rounded up thousands and thousands of Japanese immigrants. This kind of anti-immigrant targeting has been a constant feature in the United States at every point that we've had a security crisis. When you want to take action before somebody has actually done anything wrong, well, the criminal law doesn't really allow you to do that generally. Criminal law requires you to have some proof that an individual has either committed a terrorist act or has conspired to commit a terrorist act or has attempted to commit a terrorist act. It requires that you put the evidence on the table, that you give a person a fair trial. But if you use immigration law, you can find all sorts of pretextual charges to use against people. The government employs secret evidence often in immigration procedures. The same sort of fair trial rights don't necessarily apply. The Supreme Court has said that it's permissible to selectively single out people for immigration enforcement based on their affiliation with political groups. So the same sets of protections and rights don't exist, makes it easier to use the immigration process.
Dan Vara was the highest-ranking ICE attorney in the state of Florida from 2003 to 2006. He says that after the September 11th attacks, he began working closely with the FBI. His prosecutions became a model for using immigration courts as an arm of counterterrorism across the country.
2-3 days after 9/11, people like myself got the word from Washington that some of those obstacles that we had to doing some of the cases that we had been preparing for years were no longer there. And we were allowed to move forward and identify people for charges to be taken into detention and to be prosecuted, again, not criminally, but for the purpose of removing them from the United States. In Florida, once we began our work with the Joint Terrorism Task Force and even its precursor, just the FBI and other loosely associated groups, our involvement was day-to-day. We shared, at the height of my prosecution experience, FBI would feed me information every day.
Barr is proud of his work with the FBI and defends the tactic of seeking the deportation of residents against whom no criminal charges can be proven.
Many people get prosecuted and get acquitted, and they're guilty. When you sit at the table with other prosecutors from other branches of the U.S. government and agents from all these agencies, and you're reviewing evidence, I mean, the goal is to find the way to deal with the threat. And if the only thing you have is tax fraud, if the only thing you have is an immigration violation, then, frankly, that's what you use. An immigration charge is administrative in nature. The burden of proof is less than they are in a criminal trial. So even though you got acquitted in a criminal trial, the reality is that the government could still meet its burden if clear and convincing evidence. There are so many people that put their fingers in every single terrorism case that I would tell you unequivocally that mistakes are not made.
In terms of identifying actual terrorists, the government has been very ineffective. So, for example, in the first 2 years after 9/11, the government locked up, mostly using immigration powers, over 5,000 foreign nationals, almost all Arab and Muslim, in anti-terrorism preventive detention measures. Of those 5,000, not one stands convicted today of any kind of terrorist offense. So the government's record there is 0 for 5,000.
They don't have the evidence in these cases, and that's what they see as the beauty of immigration court, is heck, you don't need evidence. You just need a judge who's willing to look at all the garbage evidence and make a conclusory statement that I think you've met the burden of proof. Thank you very much. Have a nice life. Arguably, anything is the proper use of the immigration laws. Congress has designed it to be in many ways like the tax laws that cut Al Capone. Well, if we can't get them on the criminal charges where we have to meet this incredibly high burden of proof, we'll just deport somebody on an incredibly vague immigration statute. These immigration courts are part of the Department of Justice. They are in the executive. This is not a judicial branch. This is not an independent judiciary. This judge was appointed by a previous attorney general. He works for the attorney general. These FBI agents work for, oddly enough, the same attorney general. The folks that are prosecuting this case at Homeland Security are also in the executive branch. The reality is you have the executive branch being both the prosecutor, judge, and jury in this case. We should all be concerned about that. We should be concerned that there is a complete lack of judicial independence here. Why would an immigration judge, whose boss is the one, presumably, that wants to prosecute and deport this man, say, "I'm sorry, boss, you're wrong"? Boy, it would take a judge with a great deal of courage to do that.
Many people focus on the Bush administration and particularly on 9/11 and the reaction to 9/11 and on, for example, the Patriot Act. But what you miss when you focus in that way is that this is a broader problem.
Now we're in the middle of the Obama administration. Attorney General Holder has approved this. Trust me, if he hadn't approved it, we wouldn't be having this conversation. So clearly the Obama administration is continuing the same enforcement mentality that first Clinton and then the Bush administration followed in immigration.
There's involvement at the highest levels. The Secretary of Homeland Security, I would be very surprised if that person was not Janet Napolitano was not involved in this case. I would be very surprised that if that was the case. Not only because it's a terrorist case, but because of the publicity that it's getting.
A local Islamic group is speaking out about immigration officials' decision to detain Yusuf Megahed.
Having a fair trial and the jury finding not guilty, it seems like a slap in the
face. Their backup plan was to punish them in immigration.
Yusuf was arrested for one reason and one reason only, and that's because he looked Muslim.
With Yusuf's trial already underway, protests by community, religious, and civil rights groups continue to grow. In an unusual move, four of the jurors from his criminal trial, including foreman Gary Meringer, begin speaking out on Yusuf's behalf.
This just doesn't seem right.
There are things under the law that were put into effect after 9/11 that allows the government to simply say, "We think you're a terrorist, and therefore you will be detained until you have your day in court," and there's no judicial review of that determination. It's just a unilateral determination made by immigration officials.
We didn't know whether Youssef should be deported or given full citizenship and allowed to finish engineering school. What we did know a lot about was the case we saw in federal court, and based on that case, he was not guilty of anything, whether it's beyond a reasonable doubt or by a preponderance of the evidence, as might be required in immigration court, or by any measure that we saw, there was no evidence that he had done anything wrong. It's like telling the government, if that's all you got, let him go.
I've been doing criminal defense work for 15 years, and I've never heard of jurors going to the media and saying how outraged they are about what the government is doing to somebody who they just stood in judgment of. It's amazing that they would do that. But I think it says something even more about the disconnect between our government policies and what the people who live in this country want.
If I do talk to somebody about this case, what positive can come about it for me? Not forget about Youssef for a minute. Is there anything good that can happen? And the answer is no. But this is what I need to be doing. I would really like to think at the end of the day I did everything possible I could to get him a fair shake.
I was a history major, and during the pre-American Revolution, what jurors were doing and the verdicts that they were turning down and offenses that were being prosecuted by then the British government was the same sort of thing. It was, we're not going to enforce these laws are wrong, what you're doing is wrong. And that's what these jurors are saying, what you're doing is wrong. The law may allow you to do this, but it's wrong.
What do you think is going to happen at this trial?
Well, based on the evidence that I know of, it ought to be a very short finding of not guilty. But based on what I've heard about the immigration courts, the immigration judges, the influence of the government, the fact they can put on evidence and not even have to show it to the defense, what I think's going to happen is he's going to be found guilty as some sort of terrorist, aider and abettor, whatever, and sent back. Yeah, it's funny, sent back, but sent to Egypt, where he hasn't lived since he was, I think, 11 years old.
At first, I was shocked because I knew the family very well, and I knew the Mujahid family, I knew their son, I knew how good he was, and I have a son. So I was scared. I told him, you know what, I don't feel comfortable for you. What if they did the same thing to you? So it made me feel unsafe. It made me feel scared for my kids. But I felt like I can't let the fear take over me. And I start thinking, right, you know, we have rights, we're American citizens, that we should fight this. It shouldn't take this route because this is wrong. And if we don't fight now, everybody else are scared, afraid, and they're going to hide away from it. So we thought we could fight it together. And I felt, you know, we can do it. If we as a community work together, we can do it. Give me a kind of, you know, strength to stand up and fight. And the more you learn about your rights, you have to stand up for your rights. We had a privilege to fight for our rights and speak our minds and have the freedom to practice our religion. Not because I'm wearing a headscarf, that means I'm suspect. Not because I'm a Muslim, I'm a suspect. And maybe, you know, with all of us tonight, you know, are united as a community, Muslims, non-Muslims, everybody else, work together to solve this problem. No profiling whatsoever. We will be all safe, because that will be justice.
Yusuf got his family, his mother and his father and his oldest brother naturalized, but they're having mixed feelings because their son is still being held by immigration authorities. So please make dua for the family. Keep tab on the case and support in any way you can.
When anyone in our community or even in a minority community sees this case, especially because this family is immigrants, they see themselves and they see what could happen to them. And they're concerned now more than ever, especially everything that's been happening in our community with this case or nationwide. But the main point here is that we have to be aware as Americans, all Americans.
1 week into the trial, just as the defense is about to present its case, the judge makes an unexpected announcement.
The immigration judge terminated removal proceedings. He did the right thing. When the judge walked into the courtroom today, and the first thing he said was, "We're going to go over the exhibits in the case," I knew at that point we had won, because otherwise he never would have talked about the exhibits before I had presented a case. As soon as I realized that, I turned over to Youssef, and I said, I put my hand on his leg, and I said, "You won." I don't think he understood me. He looked at me, and he didn't understand. And Dustin, my co-counsel, leaned in and said, "You won the case." And then his big old grin, "You should smile now." And a big old grin came on his face. He now understands what a great victory this is, for justice in America. The government presented a case today, and the last 4 days, it was junk. It was all about junk. And as a result, the judge finally realized what it was and dismissed it. This is the second time in my 20-year career that a judge has dismissed charges against somebody and terminated proceedings based upon the government's lack of evidence. So this is a very unique happening for me, and really for any immigration lawyer.
Outside the Chrome Jail, supporters and press wait until sundown for Youssef's release.
I'm very happy for this, and I'm looking forward to go back to university.
I am feeling so happy for return my son to spend the Ramadan with us. It is the first night of Ramadan. We feel so happy by having my son to our house again. And I want to send a message for the government that this family of Mujahid, came to this country to live in peace and to work and take their degrees. Let us finish this thing. Please let us, Mujahid's family, live here in peace.
I think it's all over now. I'm happy.
Youssef is one of the very few who beat their charges in both criminal and immigration court. Despite no charges ever being filed against him, Rabia Haddad was deported to Lebanon in 2003. After being found innocent of all charges, Sami Hammoudi was held by ICE and then finally deported to Palestine. He now teaches political science at Birzeit University. They both say that the America that they left is nothing like the country they were once proud to call home.
When people ask me about living in the U.S., this is before September 11th, as compared to Lebanon or other parts of the world, I would always make the comment that, everything else aside, it's still a country of law, where everybody is equal under the law.
I felt happy in the United States because I felt for the first time that I am free to think the way I want to think, to write the way I want to write, to go wherever I want to go. It's the opposite, 100%. I did not expect what happened after September 11th.
To this day, the government can walk into anybody's home, into any company, any firm in the U.S., freeze their accounts, confiscate all their documents on the basis of doubt. All they have to do is to say, "We suspect you of terrorist activity."
In the United States, there is no justice. This is what I believe in, and this is what I teach my students. I don't believe that now inside the United States, anyone can say anything he wants. No. The American Muslims and Arabs are not exercising their full rights as other Americans. They cannot, because they will be punished. And the government has many ways to punish people if they want to. And one time, Ashcroft said, if someone spit in the street, we can try him. We can make laws to try him and put him in jail, if we want.
Civil liberties, human rights, the Bill of Rights are all things of the past. This whole matter of democracy and liberty and the rule of law, and it's just a myth now. It's just a myth. Any Muslim or any Arab living in the U.S. and hearing me say this, will not think twice about it. They know it, they feel it, they're living it. But I hope that other U.S. citizens don't end up on the wrong side of the fence to find out how bad this USA Patriot Act really is.
The mentality that will harass the Muslims and Arabs, the institutions that will harass Muslims, will harass others.
Measures first introduced against immigrants inevitably get extended and applied to U.S. citizens. So over time, it's all of our rights that are at stake. So the first measures that that criminalized speech or that penalized political speech were targeted at immigrants, but ultimately became part of our criminal laws during World War I. The first measures that imposed essentially guilt by association were introduced in the immigration law in the early 1900s, but were extended to American citizens during the McCarthy era, and thousands of Americans were affected by that guilt by association. The first sort of ethnic-based targeting enforcement was against foreign nationals from countries whose ethnicity we didn't like. During World War II, that was extended, and we ended up locking up not just Japanese immigrants, but American citizens of Japanese descent. So whether it be, you know, racial discrimination or penalizing speech or guilt by association, the measures are introduced against immigrants initially, but eventually get extended to U.S. citizens.
It created fear among the Muslim community, and a lot of people have become so concerned about stepping up to the plate and being an Americans. I mean, being American means that you have to stand up for your rights, that you speak your mind, you have freedom of worship, freedom of speech. Well, none of this has really flourished in our community after 9/11. Most people are scared to come up and speak their mind simply because they've seen what happens to those who spoke.
Controlling the community is controlling their minds, controlling their feelings. They will all the time be watchful, not to say things they like to say. They will say things that the government would like to hear. Not to do anything that they show that they are full citizen who exercise their full rights.
I think a lot of people are just very scared. Like, they wouldn't really talk about things, or they would try to, like, distance themselves. So I think it's more of just trying to get by, trying to live their lives, you know, go to school, get a job, like, just live a normal life and not really so much involvement outside of that.
Back in Tampa, the Mujahid family sit down to celebrate the beginning of Ramadan, their first meal together since Yusuf's second arrest.
I didn't imagine that we are going to sit together with Yusuf in the first day of Ramadan. Welcome back, Yusuf.
I'm relieved. I'm happy that I'm out of the this immigration jail. I was kind of expecting it that I be released, but not on a specific date, because the government did not have a case. Like, they were just holding me up for the heck of it. The government is profiling people, they're targeting people just based on their background, not of any crimes they have done. In my case, of my Muslim background, they were trying to say I'm a terrorist, or that then I have to be deported on terrorism grounds. They just want you to sign the requesting deportation and leave instead of staying and fighting your case.
We asked Yusuf what he will do now that he has won. Who does he want to be held accountable for his years in prison? Will he continue to speak out on behalf of others who are facing similar charges? His father, Samir, interrupts before Yusuf can answer.
Don't ask him many questions, because the government still now can make an appeal against him.
Do you think they will appeal, or do you think?
I didn't know. They have the right to do anything.
in the limelight.
Small teams of U.S. Special Operations Forces are involved in a low-profile proxy war program on a far greater scale than previously known, according to exclusive documents and interviews with more than a dozen current and former government officials. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Nick Turs and Alice Sperry, authors. This article is published under the heading How the Pentagon Uses a Secretive Program to Wage Proxy Wars. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. While the documents obtained by The Intercept offer clues about the scope and contours of the 127E program, much remains unknown to both the public and members of Congress. Relevant reports required by law are classified at a level that prevents most congressional staffers from accessing them. A government official familiar with the program who requested anonymity to discuss it estimated that only a handful of people in Congress, Armed Services, and Intelligence Committees read such reports. Congressional Foreign Affairs and Relations Committees, even though they have primary responsibility for deciding where the U.S. is at war and can use force, do not receive them.